And hello, thank you so much for calling. This is Nature's Answer. Thanks for calling in. Our guest will be Annie Bond. I do want to tell you, you're listening to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z with your host, Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse. And you can always find us at www.naturalnurse.com or go to Facebook, The Natural Nurse. We have many listeners participating in reading the blogs, asking questions, answering questions as well, because we're always in a learning mode and we like to see what's interesting and what's out there. For instance, we got a question just yesterday about canola oil. What are the pros and cons of canola oil? And that sounds like something, right? Canola? Guess what? There is no such thing as a canola. Canola is actually a made-up word, which means rapeseed from Canada. So it's actually a genetically modified rapeseed. That's what canola oil is. And what kind of effects it might have when you use it? Well, there's not a lot of science there. Some people think it's okay. I actually don't. I rather use, if I was going to use an oil, something that is just squeezed out of a normal plant, such as sesame oil or a good quality extra virgin organic olive oil. There's a lot of questions with olive oil as well. In fact, I will be lecturing at the Naval Expo, which happens on Long Island. You can go to navalexpo.com to find the next date. It's coming up really soon. And I will be discussing olive oil and how you can find out if your olive oil is truly extra virgin or not. And just because it says it is doesn't mean it is, because that's one of those terms that is not highly regulated and that people can make claims about when they really are not substantiated. So that's one of many pieces of information you could find out. We do have that article posted at naturalnurse.com under blogs. Just search olive oil, and you can also find out about the healing capacity of the olive leaf extract. And Nature's Answer has been providing olive leaf extract since 1972, and you can find it in other forms as well. We have lots of classes and workshops on ground. We have a class coming where we'll spend the day outside in the field gathering edible and medicinal plants, myself and our co-host, Dr. Eugene Zamperone, and we will be making them into salves, extracts, skin patches, smudge sticks, and other herbal products that you'll actually take home for yourself, that you can use for yourself and your family. Can't tell you how many calls we got after some devastating issues in the environment, such as the Sandy storm and other disruptions of electricity and life, which of course we don't know when will happen again. And people said that they had taken our classes in edible and medicinal wild plants and that they actually used it as a survival technique, because when those events happen and there's no electricity, there's no running water, there's no food left in the refrigerator because it spoils, and there's no way to get gasoline because the pumps don't work when there's no electricity either. Knowing what is growing outside your house that you can use for food and medicine becomes more than just a fascinating study and hobby, but becomes a means of ultimate survival for yourself and your family. So you're welcome to come on board with that. Dr. Z and I have written many books that include that information as well, including The Natural Medicine Chest. So if you go to naturalnurse.com and click on books, you'll see many of the books that we have written and classes that we give. We have several coming up which grant CEU credits for those of you who are professional. And that would be in botanical medicine, really looking at the pharmacology and how botanical medicines actually work. So check us out, naturalnurse.com, and also Facebook, The Natural Nurse. And we do have a guest with us this morning, and her name is Annie Bond. Annie is a best-selling author of 5 healthy green living books, including Better Basics for the Home, Home Enlightenment, that's a good word, Home Enlightenment, Clean and Green, and most recently, True Food, which was a winner of the Gourmand Awards Best Health and Nutrition Cookbooks in the World. She has authored literally thousands of articles and was named the foremost expert on green living by Body and Soul magazine. Some call her the grandmother of green, and she brings over 20 years of experience as a writer and editor about the connections between the environment, personal health, and well-being. Thank you so much for coming on board with us this morning on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Welcome, Annie.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here, and I would love to take some of those classes. They sound right up my alley because I love formulas, and so yeah. I would have loved to do that.
Yeah, we have them basically every day somewhere. We have some in Florida. We just got back from Massachusetts. We have many in the New York area. And you and listeners can find out by going to naturalnurse.com and clicking schedules. Now, what got you involved in natural living? You're talking about 20 years ago, and in my mind, that's not that long ago because I've been doing it since 1964.
So, well, when I heard that 20 years, I thought, gosh, when did I write that, or why did I pull that? Because I actually been pretty involved in the field since I got poisoned in 1980. Actually, I worked at a restaurant that had a gas leak, and it sent 80 people to the hospital. And I had at that moment what was I later learned was considered permanent central nervous system damage. And then our apartment building was exterminated with the pesticide that's been taken off the market, and I got really, really sick, and I was in the hospital for 3 months. And this was way back then, and environmental medicine wasn't really considered people didn't think of the environment so much, and so I was treated psychiatrically, and nobody could quite figure me out. And I finally, I think, got to one of the first environmental medicine people on the planet, and I just was so lucky to get to them. And they saw that my immune system was just wildly overreactive, and I became sort of a bubble case, one of the first real confirmed cases of chemical sensitivity.
You know, that's amazing, because would you believe, and I know you know this, that to this day, when doctors do an intake on a patient, it's completely ignored as a possible causative factor.
Absolutely. I had classic organophosphate pesticide poisoning, and nobody thought to look. It just was, you know, so depressing. It breaks my heart to think of how many people weren't as lucky as I was.
Yeah, you are, because what I'm saying is, although you're talking about back in the 80s, we're noticing that to this day, nobody questions any patient who has even vague symptoms similar to what you're describing. And if they don't have a specific bug, let's say, that can be isolated, nobody even asks them. Do you live in a co-op where they come in and exterminate once a month? Or do you play a sport where you're on grass that is constantly sprayed with toxic chemicals? There's no consideration of that in medicine of any kind.
It's very, very depressing, because so often the chemicals we're exposed to in the modern world are very, very neurotoxic, and so often the symptoms are mimic psychiatric illnesses, and which is what happened to me. And you know, I faithfully tried everything I could, went through therapy. What is wrong with me? And then I realized it became very clear once I got diagnosed that that it was very much related to my environment, that I could turn on depression and turn it off just as easily as anything by depending on my exposures.
So, Annie, do you remember seeing a movie by Lily Tomlin called The Incredible Shrinking Woman?
Yeah.
So, you know, that is an expose, of course, in a comic relief kind of way, because that's Lillian's venue for expression of chemical toxicity. Because if people see it again, what happens is she goes through her normal routine in the morning. So she brushes her teeth with toxic toothpaste. She washes her hair. They actually show the label with toxic chemicals. She sprays deodorant all over the place. She sprays hairspray and inhales tons of it. And then she goes to the dry cleaners, to pick up her clothes, which is loaded, of course, with butylated hydroxytoluene and all kinds of other toxins. And that, it sort of was the last straw, like what you're talking about, a cumulative exposure that causes her to go into that shrinking mode. A lot of people don't remember that about the movie.
Yeah, it's really hard. When I first got sick, people talked about the barrel analogy, and which I think is a fair one. It's a good sort of marker for people. It doesn't work for some chemicals like endocrine disruptors, but it works for just general exposure. So if you imagine every exposure you have fills a barrel. So you spray your rose bushes, you put a scented dish detergent in your dishwasher. Then you get in bed with scented sheets that have been used with laundry that had a scent in it, et cetera. Every little exposure to the synthetic chemicals add up, and they keep filling the barrel. And then many of us get to a point where the barrel overflows because there's just one too many thing. And I love that because it makes me think that for everybody, every little bit makes a difference. You don't fill everybody. Every time you choose the less toxic alternative, you fill the barrel a little less, and I really like that.
And the reaction is not immediate for most people, so therefore there's no connection made.
Yeah, absolutely. Or who thinks of the fact, for example, that they just polished the dining room table with a petroleum-based furniture polish, and then their 8-year-old boy sits down to do their math homework and is off the wall and can't concentrate, that who's making the connection between the furniture polish and the behavior?
Yes, it's totally ignored. You're so true.
Now, yeah.
What are the five basics if somebody did want to try to look at, like, how would they even know what toxins are in their environment?
Well, one of the things that I recommend is for cleaning, when you were heading towards the five basics there, I recommend people go to their cleaning cupboard or a closet or something, wherever they keep their chemicals, and look at, the government does put what they call signal words on the on products. And so what I recommend is you look at those signal words, and if it says flammable or fatal if swallowed or anything like that, that you actually take it and put it somewhere out of the house or apartment, and then call your household hazardous waste people to find out how to dispose of it.
They have disposal information, but nobody follows that. They just dump it in the garbage mostly, I would imagine.
Well, some household hazardous waste won't pick up some things, and they'll pick up others, and so the really toxic things should go into household hazardous waste, right? But like my parents-in-law had unbelievably toxic pesticides in their garage, and it was too dangerous for me to even touch, right? So I called a household hazardous waste pickup for that. But generally, I recommend that you only keep things that have a caution and nothing more serious. And the truth is that even a caution is not perfectly safe, but it's a good marker, a good delineation. So, for example, the detergents have a caution on them, and that's for good reason, because the most powerful, the highest level of childhood poisonings is very often from detergents, actually. And so
how did that happen? Wait, let's go into that a little bit more, because there might be parents listening who would be quite shocked and may need to have their eyes opened a little more clearly. So what do you mean by that?
Well, detergents aren't actually made in nature. They're synthetic, and they were designed right around World War II to do better, they thought, against things like soap scum. And so if you have hard water, soap combines with the minerals in water to make something, you know, to make soap scum. And so detergents were organized and designed to not have soap scum. And so they're made with very often petroleum-based surfactants. And it becomes surfactants, and they wash because of this. And they're not, they're just not completely safe products. I mean, not that you would want to eat soap either, which is more natural. But there's it can poison a child if they drink enough of it. I'm not exactly sure what the lethal doses, but it's something that is common enough of being, you know, severely dangerous that many, many children have to be rushed to poison control centers. So
now, what if they're using products that are commercial, but they even say like baby shampoo or something? When I read those labels, it looks like they still have lots of toxic chemicals in them.
Well, many babies, most shampoos actually are detergents and not soaps, and it's something that takes a long time. I mean, you hear of Murphy's oil soap and you assume that's a soap. It's actually a detergent. There's a very distinct difference between that, and it's very, very, very rare to find a shampoo that is not a detergent and is a soap. And again, it's for that reason, it's because it's much harder to wash. I mean, someone like me who's got fairly dry hair, if I wash my hair with soap and not a detergent, I suddenly have to wash my hair every day because it gets so, it doesn't really clean as well. Whereas a detergent, I could easily go 3 or 4 days without a problem. So
now, how would somebody know from reading? Luckily, I think the U.S. has pretty good labeling laws. I will tell you, not perfect, because being in the business of manufacturing, I actually know that very often you have to list something on the label, but there can be other things that we used in the preparation of that item that doesn't even need to be listed on the label.
Well,
so there's a lot of hidden
really
ingredients.
Tough. It's really, really tough, I got to say. And in the cleaning arena, I feel like there's been so much competition that the greener cleaning products have risen to more of the surface. And like in a health food store, I think you can be pretty reassured that most of the products there are pretty safe. Actually, in fact, I tend to be brand focused. I tend to within the arena of like a health food store, and then I go for more trusted brands that I know I've spent enough time researching or spending on their site to understand, to believe in their integrity enough that they would always have safer products. I mean, for example, there are a couple companies that I will, I just trust, right? Because I've researched them well enough. It's a very different thing in the personal care product arena. It's very, very hard. There's so many personal care products in the health food stores. It's extremely hard to find just that, like you were talking about, these really beautiful natural formulas, products that are made with these beautiful formulas. It's just, and especially when it comes to detergents, you know, you have to go for the really pure herbal products. I'm not trying to push any products here at all, but for an example would be Aubrey Organics is totally herb-based. And so, you know, you could try that for your shampoo if you would like to have something that's not a detergent. It's astonishing how many of the personal care products and health food stores even had parabens in them, and then of course there was a huge scramble to
Wait, you're going a little quick. Let's slow down, because I want people to hear that word.
Yeah.
Parabens. There's parabens. There's other parabens. How would someone know if there was a paraben in their product, and what is the problem with parabens?
Well, I think it's important to understand something about, remember back when I was talking about the barrel analogy, I said the barrel analogy really holds up except for endocrine disruptors. Parabens will be on a label. They're in products as a preservative. And so the issue will be that if you have a paraben in your personal care product, then it's what's called an endocrine disruptor. And I think it's endocrine disruptors are a huge problem in products. And I think it's worth taking a few minutes to describe what they are, if that helps. So if you imagine that we have like a receptor site in our body for hormones, and so you have a little spot where estrogen comes in, the hormone estrogen comes in and goes through your body and does what it's supposed to do. Let's say there's a chemical that mimics that estrogen, then it's going to come into the receptor site. The body thinks it's estrogen, but then it goes through the systems of the body and then it starts malfunctioning because it's not the true estrogen. It's not a true hormone. It's a synthetic version. And the way they discovered hormone disrupting chemicals was a really interesting scientist at Tufts University, and she kept getting estrogen in her petri dish, and she couldn't figure it out, and she kept pushing and pushing, like, what is causing all this estrogen? And then she realized the estrogen was actually synthetic estrogen coming from the plastic piping going into the petri dish. And so that just
raised me. So what about, wait a minute, what about everybody who gets IVs in the hospital through that plastic piping?
It's an enormous problem. It's so big that the World Health Organization has put it right up at the top of the problems in the world that absolutely have to be dealt with, and it's causing some very serious ramifications. Many studies are showing that it's endocrine disruptors that are causing the increase in breast cancer and prostate cancer, and you know, baby boys being born with testicular problems. I mean, it's extremely upsetting and terrifying. There's a wonderful book that actually launched this whole concept in the mid-90s called Our Stolen Future, and it talked about endocrine disruptors in wildlife, and that they were suspecting these PhDs and MDs that wrote the book, they were expecting that it would be showing up in humans as well, and in fact it is. So it's very, very upsetting.
So how can people screen the products that they have in their home right now if they're listening to the show, or better yet, when they're going to select new products, to know if it contains some of these substances or not?
Well, the really unfortunate thing is that with endocrine disruptors, I think it's very hard, because that we're just at the tip of the iceberg in terms of understanding what those products are. So for me, I think I settle on the best guidance I can give, which is I'm a really deep believer in the precautionary principle, which means you don't put products on the market until they're proven safe. You put them on the market only when they're proven safe and not.
Okay, but
not in-
we know that at this point, I mean, that would be a nice thing to lobby for and get a law for, which could take 10 or 20 years. I'm talking about today. Could people read labels or look at certain classes of products that might be best to avoid to cut down on the endocrine disruptors?
Quite honestly, the reason I wrote my books is so, and the reason you're giving your classes and formulas, is that this is an area where you really want to go back to basics. There's a phrase that generally regarded as safe. And so what I do when I look at labels is I look at labels and see what I can understand, and then try to find products that are in the level of simplicity that they are ingredients that are real ingredients. And so if it's a personal care product and it lists the herbs and it lists the natural materials that it comes from, then I will that's I guess my guide point. It doesn't mean that all natural things are safe, because we know they're not, but at least it's for example, toxic molds and things like that, but at least it's a starting point for returning to products that are real materials and not synthetic.
Right. And, you know, like I said, when I began investigating this, it was 1964, and it was pretty interesting. And something that I've stuck with since those days is something called Dr. Bronner soaps. And
yeah,
they
those
have
are
many
really
of
lovely.
Them.
Yeah.
When you
yeah,
read the ingredients, anyone can read those words if they can read English. You're not going to something like, you know, butylated hydrocarbons that you might not know what those mean.
Exactly. I mean, it's just really using common sense, going back to basics as much as you possibly can, which is why for my cleaning basics, there really are very, very simple ingredients. And you can, I've learned, for example, for cleaning, that you can clean anything in the house with natural materials. You do not need to, even like the most difficult projects to clean up, I've discovered ways to clean up. So,
well, we're going to talk about that when we come back. We're going to just take a 1 minute break right here. We're going to listen to one of our natural medicine chefs. And thank you so much for joining us today, listeners, on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And when we come back, we would love to hear, Annie, about some of your wonderful homemade basics for non-toxic cleaning. And, of course,
great.
you have written books about that as well. So we will be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
On this edition of the Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss the essential oil taken from the Australian tea tree.
The tea tree, known as Melaleuca alternifolia, grows in only one region of the world, the northeast corner of Australia. It is a full-sized tree of the myrtle family, whose oil has powerful abilities to clean and help heal wounds and skin ailments such as cuts, burns, and rashes. In 1770, the infamous Captain Cook was a lieutenant in the British Royal Navy when his ship landed in Australia. The botanist on board, Sir Joseph Banks, collected samples of a sticky aromatic leaf and brought them back to England for further investigation.
In 1923, an Australian curator and chemist, Dr. Penfold, conducted a study on tea tree leaves and discovered that their essential oils are 13 times stronger as an antiseptic bactericide than carbolic acid, considered the standard in the early 1900s. The oil contains 50 to 60% terpenes, 6 to 8% cineol, which causes its camphor-like odor, and several kinds of alcohols. In 1933, the Australian Journal of Pharmacy, the American Journal of the National Medical Association, and the British Medical Journal reported that tea tree oil is a powerful disinfectant, non-poisonous, non-irritating, and has been used successfully in a very wide range of septic conditions. Australian tea tree oil is mentioned in the British Pharmaceutical Codex of 1949, the UK Medicine List, and the Dispensary of the United States.
During World War II, tea tree oil was considered a standard issue item for all first aid kits for Army and Navy units in tropical regions. The demand for tea tree oil exceeded the supply. However, after World War II, synthetic drugs gained in popularity and the use of tea tree oil in medicine waned. In more recent times, a renewed interest in natural, non-toxic alternatives has triggered a resurgence in tea tree oil research. In 1985, Dr. Paul Belacher, chief of the phytotherapy department at the Faculty of Medicine, University of Paris, worked on several double-blind studies involving tea tree oil and its application as a remedy for candidiasis, chronic cystitis, staph and strep infections, and nail bed fungus. He stated, and we quote, "The essential oil of Melaleuca has entered the team of major essential oils and emerges as an antiseptic and antifungal weapon of the first order in phytoaromatherapy."
Try a few drops of tea tree oil in a steam vaporizer and inhale for blocked sinuses, or rub the oil on chest and back for a cough. The Australian Journal of Dentistry reported that using tea tree oil in dental hygiene and in surgery showed it to be an extremely effective antiseptic. Add a drop on your toothbrush or include it as a gargle and mouthwash. Tea tree oil can be applied directly to the skin. Although it's possible that some people may experience a mild allergic reaction, in-depth research has shown tea tree oil to be non-irritating and safe.
So, listeners, think about including tea tree oil, the first aid kit in a bottle, in your natural medicine chest.
And we are coming back for the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Ellen Kamite, the Natural Nurse, and you can find us at naturalnurse.com or Facebook, the Natural Nurse. And we'd love to see you in person. We are also going to be in Chinatown in New York City, where we have a full day of learning how Chinese herbs are made into traditional Chinese medicine. We actually go to a factory where they do that. We do Qigong in the park. We teach you about tongue and pulse diagnosis, wild plants that grow even in New York City that can be used for natural medicine, such as ginkgo biloba trees, and a whole host of other information. It's like going away to another country for the day, so you can find out more and join us by going to naturalnurse.com and click schedules. Today, we have as our guest Annie Vond. Annie is the best-selling author of 5 healthy green living books, and she is telling us today about how you can include healthier alternatives in your home rather than inundating yourself, your cells, and your family with toxic chemicals through the use of conventional cleaning fluids, body care products, and other environmentally toxic chemicals. Now, Annie, how is it that these things are not more regulated by the government? People think the government is taking care of them.
Well, that's one of the unfortunate, sad myths that really exists. The only real label that's required is those signal words that I was talking about, and it's just extremely depressing that that is the case. And in cleaning products, there are many. I mean, I was just doing some research on dryer sheets, for example, and the ingredients in there many of the ingredients don't have to be on the label.
I didn't hear what you said. You said you were doing research on dryer sheets. I don't know what dryer sheets are. So what are dryer sheets?
Dryer sheets are sheets that, you sound like me. I don't know a bunch of these things either, but they're, a lot of people come to me because they've gotten very, very sick from these. They are, because of static cling and to get softer clothes, a lot of people put what they call the dryer sheets into the dryer, and it's a piece of paper that's been saturated with surfactants, these detergents, and very strong scents, and often you can get them unscented, but and other chemicals, and they're put into a dryer and to take away static cling. And,
you know what's amazing? How did I get to be in my mid-60s? How did I live this long without ever using a dryer sheet? You know, I mean, why do we need dryer sheets?
Well, a friend of mine, I'm not much behind you there, and in age, and a friend of mine who's my age, daughter, who was in her mid-20s, looked at me with her jaw hanging open because I couldn't have her in my house because of her clothes reeked of these dryer sheets. And she said, but how do you do laundry without them? And I
Oh, my God. That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think for a lot of people, they feel like this is absolutely what has to happen. And so one thing is that natural materials, you won't get the same static that you get with natural materials, so you won't have socks attack, you know, clinging to the sheets and everything if they're made of polyester. But if they're made of natural materials, they won't so much. But I have some alternatives to them. But honestly, they're put a surfactant on these cloths that are put in the dryer that coat a little fine layer of material on clothes. And what people don't understand is that they also coat a little fine layer of chemicals in your lungs. And I get more people that have asthma and troubles that have developed because of too many dryer sheets in their house all the time.
That's amazing. I'm sure people would never even think about that as a source of someone actually being ill. I mean, what about a baby?
Oh, yeah, and the little growing, you know, the little lungs and airways and all that kind of thing. It's dryer sheets are actually sort of a bugaboo for me because it's I just have been exposed enough to people that are wearing clothes that have them or in homes that are, you know, reek of these dryer sheets because there's this one of the reasons, part of the chemistry that they felt, the developers felt was so wonderful is they developed a way to make the perfume, the synthetic perfumes last as long as possible. And so that's part of what then you get into is having these perfumes that are long-lasting stuck on your and then combined with this sticky material that gets on your clothes, then wafting around your house all the time. It's just a really for people that are sensitive to synthetic perfumes, which is a very large percentage of the country. I think it's like 38% say that they're sensitive to synthetic perfumes. You know, this is a huge problem, so.
just amazing. I mean, how bad would the world be if we just didn't have dryer sheets at all? Now, what are some of the natural alternatives that you might mention for people who feel they can't live without this?
So the one thing that really works is vinegar. You don't need to add vinegar to the rinse cycle of the laundry, but that's one way to do it. But people move to dryer sheets because that's inconvenient. So one thing you'd be able to do is just to take a small 6 by 6 inch piece of like old flannel sheet or old T-shirt or something like that, and just saturate it in some vinegar and throw that into the dryer, and that would help change the chemical balance that would make the static cling go away. Another thing you could do if you can tolerate essential oils would be to put a few drops of like lavender, pure lavender essential oil or something onto a cloth and put it in the dryer, and then you'd have a slight lavender, you know, scent to your clothes. But my personal recommendation is just to not do anything. That use natural materials for your clothing as much as possible, and just dry the clothes as normal, and it'll be fine.
So the thing is that we can either just not have them at all, or now you talked about vinegar quite a bit, and I know that's one of my main cleaning implements. I would say baking soda and vinegar are the things that I use most to clean with. And you would think vinegar will, you know, it has a scent, and it's not a pleasant scent like Mountain Dew or whatever they call those fake things. But it goes away very, very quickly once you've used it in the home.
It totally dissipates really, really fast. And I've certainly had many people talk to me about that they hate the smell and that sort of thing. You could put a few drops of lavender or whatever essential oil you prefer along with the vinegar on that piece of cloth, and that will really help overpower the smell of the vinegar. But it's interesting that I you can't make this kind of thing up, but I was on a plane from LA to New York, and I sat down, and who should be next to me, it turned out, but the world's vinegar expert from Australia.
Oh my God, and that is really something.
Yeah, it was really something. And it was so synchronistic. And you know, he talked about what an incredible disinfectant vinegar is, and that it's it just is like beyond all. And the more research I've done and found out about it, I've learned, you know, that it kills germs, it kills mold, it kills bacteria. It doesn't have a 99% kill rate, but it's really, really strong. So I think it's a fantastic solution for non-toxic living, and I use it all the time, just absolutely all the time.
So first of all, do you have a favorite kind? I mean, is there organic vinegar, and then they talk about balsamic or regular, the real cheapo one, regular white. What's the difference, and how do they work?
For cleaning, I only recommend using white distilled vinegar that you could buy in the supermarket, because I don't want people to stain their clothes, so the stronger, or stain anything, right? So the stronger vinegars are the more organic and natural the organic ones all, or balsamic certainly would stain a couch if you were using that. So I recommend people use the white distilled.
And that's so inexpensive. You can just buy that big bucket of it.
Well, it's $1.38 or something for a gallon. It's very,
exactly.
Very cheap. I mean,
exactly.
Yeah, I was once on a radio show back in the 90s. I was on Smart Money, and they asked me to compare the prices of making your own cleaning products versus having the, buying the commercial version. And I painstakingly, ounce for ounce, compared it. And the commercial products, for just the basics, came to about $66. And then For the natural materials that I used, ounce for ounce again, and this included a very expensive tea tree oil, essential oil, it came to $11. So the savings, the financial savings alone are just enormous. And I find that with some of my formulas, like I'll give you my favorite sauce scrub, for example, and a few formulas, the only thing I buy really is are essential oils, and that are expensive are essential oils, and I buy a really good green detergent because I have hard water and do like to not have soap scum, and I do use a detergent for that. But otherwise, it's baking soda. My five basics that I use are baking soda, washing soda, which was my best discovery for really super-duper heavy cleaning projects that generally normally what people would think of using a solvent for. And so I can give you some suggestions for that. Vinegar, and then a good soap or detergent. Your Dr. Bronner's is a great choice for a soap. A detergent, you'd want to go with a company like Seventh Generation or Ecovair that use green detergents that are, the surfactants are made from vegetables and not from petroleum. And then my fifth ingredient, which with my increased sophisticated understanding about vinegar is not as essential, but I like it for big, when you have a big mold problem, and that is tea tree oil, because it's a broad spectrum fungicide, and I'll put a teaspoon of tea tree oil to a cup of water, and I'll use that.
Well, those are, you know, let me make a comment about tea tree oil, because I'm not sure if you heard the natural medicine chest that we did in our last break, which Dr. Zamperone and I recorded, which was a full discussion of tea tree oil, the science as well as the folklore. But I do want to throw this out there. Very often we have people using these therapies and information that they hear on our many radio shows, and I'm sure by looking at your website, which is anniebond.com, is that correct?
It's Annie B. Bond.
AnnieBBond.com, put the little B in there. You know, they see something like tea tree oil and they might use it, but I do need to throw out a caution, because tea tree oil is extremely toxic to cats. And I know someone who used tea tree oil all the time, like I do at home, for many, many things. And then their cat got some kind of skin rash and they applied it to their cat and the cat licked it off and did die.
Oh, my word. I had no idea. I know that about some other materials. I had no idea about cats. Wow.
Yeah,
so, I've researched this a lot, so that's interesting. Thank you so much. Goodness.
Well, that's the thing. That's the thing, that we can't just use everything natural as if it's non-toxic either. But tea tree oil is a great example. So I would say it's wonderful to use around the house. But if you do have a cat companion animal, I would just make sure you use it when not in an amount that's going to get on them. That's the only thing.
That's a great point. And I have another example, which is this citrus peel extract, which is called eulaimonene. Kills absolutely all stages of the flea. So for those who don't want to use, I mean, so many people get sick from flea bombs, and so using citrus peel extract to kill fleas in your house is beyond the, it's just like a dream, because, as I say, it kills all stages of the flea. But it, too, is very toxic to cats, and it's a natural volatile organic chemical, so it's not good for people with asthma. But you get into these slippery slopes, like for me, who doesn't have asthma and doesn't have cats, it's an incredible blessing, because I have lots of dogs, you know, but it's a slippery slope in terms of, you know, perfection. It could be better in terms of health and the environment, but it could be a lot worse too.
Yes, that's true. Now, so that would be a good choice to have that around the house. Now, you know, I use baking soda all the time, and something that's amazing to me is taking baking soda just in a dish all by itself, and I like the brands that are guaranteed to be aluminum-free, although even the regular brands work, and adding a little water and making it into a thick paste, and then painting that onto even anything that's really deep dirt, like something that's baked on a pan. In my situation, I'm thinking now of a sweet potato, that kind of leaked sweet potato juice that really solidified on a pan in the oven.
Right.
And I painted it on there, left it overnight, and when you come back, it just washes off. It's amazing.
I know, it's an amazing. Actually, I use baking soda for oven cleaning for just exactly that reason. It actually eats through the grime like no other. I mean, it's just, you just sprinkle the bottom of the oven with baking soda and sprinkle that with water so it's damp, but it looks like it's completely covered like snow. And in the morning you just wake up and you just rinse it off, and it's amazing. It really is. My favorite baking soda recipe actually is my soft scrubber, and what I do there is I put about a half a cup of baking soda in a bowl, and I squirt in enough soap or detergent and stir it in to make it like a frosting texture, and then I scoop that on a sponge, and it's just unbelievable for the bathtub or the kitchen sink, or even stainless steel appliances, because one thing about it is that it rinses really, really well, and baking soda without
the detergent. We will come back to that, because we do have to take another break right here. We're having such a great discussion. You are listening to Annie Bond right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, and we'd like to get Progressive Radio Network, which is our home station here, to let you know about all the fabulous shows that you can listen to right here on PRN.FM. We'll be right back with more.
Hi, this is Tony Hendra
and Jeff Chrysler
of the Final Edition Radio Hour
on PRN,
your source for organic,
gluten-free,
sustainable
satire.
Hi, I'm Sandy Leon Best, host of Political Analysis. Welcome to the 21st century, where the corporate propaganda machine works 24/7 to manufacture your reality. Every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time, Political Analysis challenges the corporate narrative with independent news, analysis, and passionate conversations on the most critical issues of our time. Don't let the corporate echo machine become your truth. Tune in live to Political Analysis or visit the archives at prn.fm. If you like the show, rate us in iTunes. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
Complex is private. One hand washes the other. That's why drugs are illegal. It's a moneymaker for everybody. It's just like with war. That's why we don't want peace, because our number one export's weapons.
What's going on there, man? How you doing?
What was the question again?
The question was, would you eat your pet?
No. If I had to, yes.
Bear Man Radio Show is live Thursday nights at 9 in the East on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Charlene Spretnak. I'm the host of All Together Now, a program about recent discoveries that human life is far more dynamically interrelated than modern society's thought. I hope you'll join me and my guests for All Together Now on Thursdays at 3 o'clock Eastern Time. If you can't catch the live broadcast, it's available in the archives at prn.fm. If you like All Together Now, please rate it at iTunes. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
This is Dr. Jack Rasmus, host of the radio show Alternative Visions on the Progressive Radio Network, every Wednesday, 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Join me next Wednesday, September 18th, when I will interview three delegates to the recent AFL-CIO convention. We'll discuss the Labor Federation's historic decision to include community organizations as official union members. Is this something real, or just the same old business to lobby Democrat politicians? That's Alternative Visions, next Wednesday, September 18th, 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
PRN.FM, bringing you new shows and fresh ideas every day. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Welcome back once again right here to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Thank you so much for joining us today. This is Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse, and you can find us at naturalnurse.com or Facebook, The Natural Nurse. And our guest today is Annie Bond, and she is known as the godmother of green. She brings over 20 years of experience about the connections between the environment, personal health, and well-being, which she has been sharing with us this whole hour. And she has also wrote a beautiful publication called The Green Guide. You can find out more about her work at anniebond.com. It's a B, though, Annie B. Bond. So it's A-N-N-I-E. B, and then B-O-N-D, AnnieBBond.com. Thank you so much for joining us today. Tell us about the Green Guide. What is that? It's award-winning. It's a publication. How do people get a hold of it?
That was launched in about 1994, and it was with Mothers and Others for a Livable Planet, and that was the organization that Meryl Streep started with Wendy Gordon. And Meryl Streep was so frustrated because she had four kids and she was feeding them apples, and then she started learning about some of the chemicals that were in the apples, that she went to Natural Resources Defense Council and wanted to start an organization that would help mothers find less toxic alternatives for their kids. And so I was the editor of that publication in the mid-90s, and eventually it got bought by National Geographic, and so I think that it's still online at thegreenguide.com. During the sort of more recent publishing upheavals, they sort of shuttered it for a while because it just was hard to get the business model working for them, I guess. But it was really a seminal publication. I was very honored to be the original editor of it, and there are back issues available, I think, and it delved into all of the issues we're talking about and more. I mean, looking in a sort of a granular way, looking at one thing after the other, like, you know, what about coffee? What about dry cleaning? What about, you know, what about RBGH in milk? You know, so it was a really great publication.
And it's not something that's around now, but it's something that you did previously, and it was award-winning. So we're actually getting to, you know, towards the end of our time together, and we want to, you know, get some more of your great recipes in. I know you just gave us a wonderful one about looking at baking soda, but let's, what is this book that you have on 1,000 folk formulas?
Well, that's Better Basics for the Home, and that's, I think, one of my very best books in terms of formulas, which sort of links back to the beginning of the show when you were talking about your formulas. I just love the folk formulas because, I wrote my first book, Cleaning Green, and it was all about cleaning, and I just ended up having some natural love of reading about, I probably have a library of more of the folk formulas than anybody on the planet, and I was lucky enough for my first book to have a publisher that just insisted I test every single recipe. So I worked and worked and worked on those recipes and formulas and ended up coming up with things that I think really work. And then for Better Basics for the Home, I really wanted to expand. I wanted to understand more about the personal care arena in terms of formulas. And so I spent a year going to different herbalists, going to Green Nations, which is the herbalist conference, and plowing through and testing all of these herbal recipes for skincare and baths and all that kind of thing. And I just absolutely loved it. But Better Basics for the Home goes into also things like for renovating, like how do you make milk paint and Play-Doh and, you know, all of those things. So, you know, in some ways my work is a little obsolete. I wrote it back before there was a green product for everything, a product that was a non-toxic, or I felt sort of met my bar of what a non-toxic product was, before there were all these green products. And now I think you could pretty much buy a ready-made product that's safe for just about anything you would want to do, which is really good news. It's a great credit to how many people have worked so hard in the field to come up with, you know, a green product arena. So,
well, I still think, for one thing, the things that you are offered are extremely easy to make. And if anybody has an objection to the additional cost of the natural products, this completely takes care of that because it couldn't be cheaper.
It couldn't be cheaper, and as I say, I sort of mix and match. I buy a few things, like a green detergent and essential oils, and the rest is just couldn't be cheaper. And so with those ingredients that I mentioned, there are a few little tricks. Like, for example, a lot of people around Earth Day 1990 gave up on green cleaning, thinking it, and thinking it just didn't work because editors would say, you know, use vinegar to wash the windows. And they would try it, and they would get streaks, and they would sort of give up on it. But they didn't realize that the first time they cleaned their windows after having used a commercial product that was full of the waxes, that they needed a little dab of detergent or soap in that with the vinegar and water to cut away all of the old wax. But once they had gotten the old commercial cleaning product off of their windows, they were fine with vinegar from then on. So some myths developed, you know, that green cleaning is really expensive, that it doesn't work. And I can't tell you that, I mean, not that I like to clean, but I do clean, and I clean everything in the house, and I just, especially with washing soda paste, which is in the same family of material as baking soda, it's just processed differently, and it will peel wax off a floor. It'll take, and the same kind of paste you were talking about where you paste it on, you know, a really damp paste, it'll take soot off of a fireplace. It'll clean an engine oil spill.
It's amazing, isn't it? I mean, if anybody tries it, you just can't believe it. Like, you put it on there sort of as a paste, and then I let it dry overnight. I don't know how long
you
do it
for. Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. When people find that minerals don't work well for them, it's because they haven't used enough. They haven't let it stay long enough, and they haven't had it damp enough. And if you make sure it's damp and you let it set long enough, for the oven with the baking soda, I just do that, let it set overnight, and you use enough of the material, then it works like magic, really.
Yeah, that's just amazing, and so inexpensive, works so well, and decreases your exposure to the many toxic chemicals that we've been talking about. Now, what about something that repels ticks? Because that's something that scares a lot of people. Getting Lyme disease is just awful.
Well, it's very awful, and I've suffered from it this summer myself, in fact. But what I found is that back in that time I was telling you, it took a year to just research herbs, and I was really digging hard for a tick repellent because I felt like that was just really key to where I live, which is in upstate New York, and many people are, I mean, ticks are pretty much around the country now. And I found that a material that was just the herbalists call it tickweed, but it's rose geranium is the sort of standard name for it. And it does repel the ticks really, really well. And I would use it. I put a few drops on my dog's collar, and you just have to be very, very careful not to use too much with dogs because they're really sensitive to the scent. But it's very effective. Or for yourself, I would put, like in a tablespoon of extra virgin olive oil, I would add a few drops. I would say maybe even 10 drops to a tablespoon of rose geranium, and then you could dab it a little bit on your skin, like on your wrists or whatever, or even on the outside on your clothing if you're going to go into the woods or are concerned about it. So that's one really good thing. Another thing that ticks are really repelled by sulfur, so you can get bisulfur at garden supply stores and get flakes, and you can sprinkle it around on your lawn, and that will help repel it. There are also carbon dioxide emitters that will draw ticks to them that can cover acreage, and you could buy those and set those around.
Well, that is all just excellent information, and I want to thank you so much for being our guest today on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, and I'm really happy that you were able to join us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been really fun.
And listeners, I'd like to tell you that you can find Annie, as we have said, definitely at the website. That's Annie B. Bond, all one word, AnnieBBond.com. And then also you can check out our website at naturalnurse.com. And I'd like to have a shout out also to the station Progressive Radio Network, because Progressive Radio Network brings you a wide variety of really high-level information that you need to know and that you're not going to hear anywhere else. So you can go to prn.fm And hopefully the archives will be back really soon so you can listen to any of our past shows as well as catch whatever current shows are on right now. And we have a lot of our past shows also posted at ehearit.com. That's ehearit.com. And there's a link there from naturalnurse.com. So once again, I'd like to thank you all so much for joining us today right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And until next time, we hope that you stay healthy.